Okay, we're ready. Okay, good evening, everybody. Tonight, we're going to discuss Operation Choriv and the end of the War of Independence for Israel and the armistice agreements that followed the war. Last week, we discussed the third round of fighting, which occurred in the second half of October and in early November, was a favorable round for Israel, but not entirely decisive, did not bring the war to an end as much as Israel would have wanted it to. And it was certainly clear, both to the Israelis and to their Arab opponents, that a further round was going to be necessary from the Jewish perspective. It was just a question of when. Would there be a pretext, or even without a pretext? So Operation Choriv began on December 22nd, 1948, and Egypt knew something was coming. But they didn't know where it was coming. Would the IDF action take place in the direction of Gaza, or would it take place in the direction of the Hebron Hills? In other words, would there be an assault on the southern West Bank or on the strip of territory along the coast bordering Egypt? The goal was to expel the Egyptians from the country and have them sue for peace, on the premise that if they're not thoroughly routed and defeated, they will not sue for peace. So it's necessary to have a big win to guarantee some kind of political diplomatic aftermath that is acceptable to Israel. So air and artillery fire were aimed at Egyptian positions all along the coastal strip. At that point, Egyptian, Saudi, and Sudanese forces in the area totaled 20,000 people. Now, 20,000 sounds like a big number, and it is a big number, but bear in mind that these were weak forces. These were not necessarily the best trained fighters, but were they well stocked with ammunition? They were on their last legs, to be honest. Now, Choriv would be an indirect approach rather than a head-on assault against Gaza.
Can you turn it louder?
The intention was to trap the core of the Egyptian army between El Arish in the Sinai and Gaza City. In other words, cut them off in between so that they can't escape. They're trapped, they'll have to sue for peace. The IDF would swing forces southward and then push northward along the international border and catch the Egyptians from behind and threaten the Sinai Peninsula itself. So no longer was the issue just kicking them out of Palestine or Israel, but rather a real threat towards Egypt. There was a diversion, because you always have to have a diversion. You can't just do a swing around. You have to have a diversion, which is a head-on assault. And that was at Hill 86. And sadly, a lot of Israelis died in that incident. However, as much as it wasn't a victory, it was a victory insofar as it confused the Egyptians into thinking that a head-on assault was likely, and they were caught off guard with the end around. Okay. Now, Yigal Alon's forces moved southward towards the border and were able to defeat static Egyptian defenses. This was a classic case of mobility versus that the Egyptians were immobile, they were stuck in trenches and defensive postures they couldn't escape from, and the Israelis were moving quickly in half tracks and vehicles. Okay. Alon kept his intentions secret from the IDF general staff, because really his intention was not just to oust the Egyptians from Eretz Yisrael, but rather to invade Egypt, to conquer Abu Aghela, about 20 miles into the Sinai, and then move northbound and capture El Arish, the major town in the northeast Sinai. He feared that political considerations would lead his superiors in the army and in the civilian defense establishment to forbid such operations on foreign soil. And guess what? He was right. They would forbid it once they got wind of it. The Jewish soldiers who were under his command were excited to be taking the fight to the enemy. They were giddy, they were jumping for joy as they crossed the international frontier, that after having suffered from the enemy invading their country, they were happy to invade the other guy's country. Okay. Now, Alon's superiors, notably Yigal Yadin, who was the acting head of the IDF at the time, and David Ben-Gurion, the defense minister and prime minister, were busy when all this went down on December 27th through the 29th. They were occupied with other things. What other things? And what's more important than invading a foreign country? Well, Yadin was sick in bed with the flu, so he was, you know, not on top of his game at that point. And Ben-Gurion was busy negotiating with the Soviets, raising money from the Americans, and negotiating peace with the Jordanians. So there was a lot on his plate at the time. There's hardly anything in Ben-Gurion's personal diaries about the capture of Abuja, which was the spot where the Egyptians had their defensive position just over the border, on the Israeli side of the border, or for that matter, the invasion of Egypt. The only reference we have in Ben-Gurion's diaries is that he thought Abu Aghela might be the site of Chet HaEgel. Aghela, Egel, Chet HaEgel. Ben-Gurion was always interested in taking names for places, comparing them with biblical episodes and saying maybe they're one and the same. Okay. So, what happened here? As is the case with the invasion of Lebanon, so too with the invasion of Egypt, the Israeli cabinet was basically silent. That they didn't have votes and serious decisions and formal discussions about these things. Things just happened. Countries get invaded, and the government didn't talk about it. How could that be? Well, in the case of Egypt, it could be that because the international response to Operation Hiram and the invasion of Lebanon was so tepid that the Goyim hardly did anything about it, so maybe if we got away with it once, we'll get away with it again. And that's not bad thinking, by the way. But when Yadin got wind of Alon's plans, he told him to stop. Stop. Don't go any further. Alon didn't listen. He was insubordinate, and he pushed his forces further. However, he personally flew back to Tel Aviv to negotiate with Yadin over whether this operation would have his hechsher, his seal of approval. Alon had Yitzhak Rabin tell Yadin about Abu Ghela, but never mentioned that the real intention was to invade and capture El Arish. So here, the commander on the ground is lying to his IDF superior and to the defense ministry, and having his subordinates do the lying for him. All right, but so it was in 1948-49 in Israel. Now, by nightfall on December 29th, IDF forces were only 6 miles away from El Arish, having captured every defensive Egyptian position up until that point. There were deep raids into the Sinai, into central Sinai, on December 29th and 31st, and the IDF captured hundreds of Egyptian prisoners. Others just fled on foot, literally barefoot, back across the Sinai to the Suez Canal. So Egyptian soldiers were happy to be captured by the Israelis because the alternative was to walk 100 miles barefoot on hot sands with no bread and water. Okay. Yadin cabled Alon and ordered him to stop immediately. Again, Alon flew back, and Yadin wouldn't budge. So Alon would have to concede. He will not capture El Arish. He'll withdraw to Abu Ghela. Why was Yigal Yadin so adamant that the IDF cannot seal the victory? That why does he have to hold his army back? After all, victory is good. Isn't victory good? You'd rather have victory than defeat. So why rob your own army of a major possible victory? What was the reason? So one possibility is that Yadin was afraid that Alon's forces were of insufficient size to hold El Arish, to capture El Arish, and to hold it long term. So you don't take something on if you can't hold it. Secondly, he was afraid of the international reaction. What will the Western world say if little Israel turns out not to be little Israel, but rather an expansionist power taking over somebody else's country? Okay. So he did, however, permit Alon to try to conquer the Gaza Strip by moving northbound on the Israeli side of the border. As long as you don't cross the border, if you're on our side of the border, you can move northbound and try to encircle the Egyptians at Gaza, by taking Rafah rather than El Arish. Okay, and so that would be the plan in the second phase of Operation Chorev. But still, Yigal Alon, he's not happy. So he makes one last-ditch attempt on December 30th to speak to David Ben-Gurion directly, let me conquer the Sinai. And Ben-Gurion did not do it. He did not let it happen. Why? Well, Ben-Gurion was afraid of Ernest Bevin. Ernest Bevin, the foreign minister of England, was regarded as an anti-Zionist and maybe even an anti-Semite. And there's a good case to be made that he was an anti-Semite. And if the Jews are attacking Egypt. Egypt, which is in a treaty, the Anglo-Egyptian treaty with Britain, then maybe, just maybe, British forces stationed at the Suez Canal will come rushing to the front and destroy little Israel. So Ben-Gurion is very afraid of that possibility and says we can't risk it. Okay. International pressure against Israel was not yet strong, but it was growing. And it was something that you had to worry about. The Egyptians were desperate for the British to intervene militarily, and Britain was pressing the Americans to stop the Israelis. Each side is pressuring its superpower, and the superpower is pressuring the other. But Bevin was reluctant to engage the British in this fight because he didn't know the truth. Is Egypt really losing, or is Egypt lying? Remember, Arab propaganda is a big deal. And Arab propaganda always says during the war that they're winning, that the Jews are losing, the Jews are going to be pushed into the ocean, we're going to slaughter every last one of them, we're going to commit a genocide, hooray. Okay, that's Arab propaganda. Well, some people believe it. And in the Western world, if you don't have reconnaissance missions and you don't have U-2 flights over 70,000 feet above the surface watching what's going on, or satellite imagery, you really don't know. And if the propaganda is that the Egyptians are winning, but privately the Egyptians are saying we're losing and Israel's going to destroy us, well, what's the emes? What's the truth? The British were not really sure at first. But eventually they came to realize that the Egyptians really were on the brink of defeat. And Bevin threatened to invoke the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty and to begin selling arms to the Arabs. There had been an arms embargo by Western powers against the Middle Eastern countries, including the Arabs and the Jews. But Bevin said, if the Jews are getting Soviet weapons from the Czechoslovakians, then we ought to be able to sell and fulfill our hardware contracts to the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Iraqis. Okay. By December 30th, the Americans are getting annoyed with Israel. And the Truman administration sends the ambassador, James McDonald, to Tiberias, to Ben-Gurion's vacation home, to read an angry letter saying America is not happy with you. Stop it. Cut it out. To which Ben-Gurion responded to McDonald, hold your horses, pal. There's no need to be so angry about it. We agreed to withdraw. Our forces are already turning around, and they'll be crossing the international frontier back to our side. In fact, this is what happened. By January 2nd, every single Israeli soldier was back across the international border in Israel. Not an Israeli hoof remained behind in Egypt. So, Chorev Part 1 was over. It was militarily a great success, but was diplomatically a problem in the sense that it cut the military adventure short. Israel was upset with the double standard. What double standard? Well, the Egyptians get to invade Palestine/Israel, take a lot of territory. Nobody says they're evil. Nobody screams bloody murder that they invaded a foreign country. But when the Jews invade Egypt, everyone says you can't do this. So Israel was very upset about this double standard. Well, Operation Chorev Part 2 is definitely going to follow. And this time, you have to attack through Rafah, not through the Sinai, so you don't get in trouble with the Gentiles, with the heathens in the West. Okay. But again, in this round of fighting, despite the intention of remaining on the Jewish side of the border, the road took the IDF forces going northbound slightly across the frontier. And so the next battle lasted from January 3rd to January 7th. And again, Israel was on the verge of a major victory, but international pressure forced a ceasefire, and Israel withdrew because Egypt threw in the towel. Egypt was finally ready to capitulate and call for real armistice talks, not just another phony ceasefire. Alon was furious, because Alon is always the one who wants to fight to the bitter end and win, 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 not have a piece of paper peace treaty. Yaakov Dori, who was the head of the IDF General Staff, he criticized Alon and said, you have to be quiet. You have to shut up, basically. You're a military officer, and the military doesn't run this country. The civilian leadership runs the country. The defense minister runs this war. It's not your place to criticize the civilian leadership. So keep your mouth shut. Okay? This is an ongoing issue in Israeli society for the next 70 years. Do military commanders have the right, the responsibility, or the solemn obligation not to engage in this kind of discussion openly. Okay. Well, Ben-Gurion was excited about the prospect of armistice talks with the Egyptians. Why? Because Egypt was the linchpin of the Arab world. If Egypt is willing to talk, the others will follow. The Jordanians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, maybe even the Iraqis, the Saudis. But if Egypt doesn't do it, nobody's going to do it. So you have to get Egypt. When they're ready, we talk. Okay. Well, Israel evacuated the last positions it held across the frontier on the night of January 9th and 10th. And armistice negotiations began at Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, under the mediation of Dr. Ralph Bunche, the American official who worked for the UN. And they would go reasonably well and be concluded in late February. But there is another element of the story before we can get to the armistice negotiations. And that has to do with British RAF, Royal Air Force planes being shot down by Israel. So the British flew reconnaissance missions over Israel in November and December of 1948. In late November, Israel shot down a British plane. The British flew such and the pilot was killed. The British flew such missions near the border on December 30th through January 6th, all without incident. But on January 7th, that all changed. Israel downed four Egyptian planes, British planes, all Spitfires, southwest of Rafah, on the Egyptian side of the border. One pilot was killed, two were captured, and one escaped. The Israeli pilots who did the shooting actually were not really Israeli. They were American and Canadian volunteers who were not Jewish. Okay, Asher asks a question. Was Egypt's loss of face capitulating provoked the eventual overthrow of King Farouk and the introduction of Nasser to recoup the country's honor? So the answer to that, Asher, is yes. King Farouk lost a lot of credibility in the 1948 war. He is greatly to blame for the fact that the war happened at all. And his grotesque anti-Zionism led to a lot of deaths on his side and the other side. That he lost and lost badly meant that the army wanted to get rid of him. And the Free Officer Corps, which was being recruited at Fallujah during the ceasefire, in the various ceasefires of 1948, 4 years later, would give him the heave-ho. They would send him on a boat back to Italy, where he would die a few years later of cancer. Okay, so you have now a situation where the Israelis are downing British planes, but the British didn't know exactly what happened. All they know is four planes left the Suez base and never came back. So the British sent 19 more planes up in the air to try to find the wreckage of the other four planes. Well, these 19 planes did not have their guns cocked, and they had their sights downward, looking for wreckage on the floor. They were not ready to engage in combat. Well, the Israelis didn't know who was coming. They couldn't tell if it was Egyptian or British. The sun was setting behind the British planes, making visibility even more complex. And so Azar Weitzman and a bunch of his buddies went up there and fired on these planes, and a bunch of them got knocked down. So lo and behold, more British soldiers are killed by Israel. One plane crashed 10 miles inside of Israeli territory. The British were furious. Ben-Gurion was scared about a possible British intervention. He rushed back to Tel Aviv from his vacation in Tveria, and everybody's really nervous. London considered ending the arms embargo against the Arabs and doing some aggressive measure against Israel, but in the end they chose not to do so. And they just landed a small force at Aqaba to bolster the Jordanians. Surprisingly, instead of attacking Israel, they offered de facto recognition of Israel's existence. The rest of the cabinet restrained the anti-Semitic Bevin, and they realized that now is not a time to pick a fight with the Jewish state. The war was over. There's no need for another round of fighting, and Britain certainly doesn't need to get involved. Churchill, the conservative leader, criticized the Labour government for their handling of the whole affair, And the Americans told the British to simmer down. Don't start a ruckus over this. Israel was afraid that for a few more days that the British were going to do something, and they organized Operation Yefet in case of a joint British, Jordanian, and Iraqi invasion. But nothing ever came of it. Bevin simmered down, and it was all over. In fact, the British did the Jews a favor. They opened up Cyprus to immigration to Israel. So what could have been a real problem ended up being actually a favorable development. Okay, British recognition and the opening of Cyprus. There was one last attempt to fight the Egyptians at Fallujah. And it didn't go well. It didn't go well at all. In fact, this was the worst operation of the whole war. 88 Israeli soldiers died, 5 went MIA, and 66 were wounded. It was a horrific battle and probably wasn't necessary. The Egyptians fought bravely. Why did they fight so bravely? Possibly because they feared being killed in an atrocity by the Jews, because in fact some Egyptians were killed in an atrocity by the Jews. So Operation Chisul, or Operation Liquidation, failed. The Fallujah pocket would remain, including with Gamal Abdel Nasser, until they left under the flag of the Red Cross as part of the armistice on February 24th. Chorev scared the Jordanians because they figured we're the next target for Israel. And they desperately wanted peace negotiations. And finally, the British gave their surrogates, the Jordanians, the permission to pursue armistice negotiations. The war now is basically over. Let's get to the peace. So the war ends formally with these armistice agreements. Egypt on February 24th, Lebanon on March 23rd, Jordan on April 3rd, and Iraq on July 20th. The Iraqis refused. Why did the Iraqis refuse? Because Iraq has a long history of being proud of the fact that it is the most virulently anti-Zionist country in the world, maybe anti-Semitic country in the world. They hate the Jews with a passion. And there was no need for an armistice treaty because there's no common border between Israel and Iraq. In truth, however, there was a friction and a common border in the sense that there were Iraqi troops in the West Bank, and that had to be dealt with, and it was dealt with in the deal with Jordan. Okay. So Ralph Bunche leads the talks at Rhodes. Egypt is in a tough spot. How is Egypt in a tough spot? Well, the fate of the regime was tied to the fate of the army. As Asher asked a few moments ago, did the loss of face result in Farouk's demise? The answer is yes, and Farouk knew it. So he had to, if not win the war, at least try to win something of the peace. Make sure it's not an embarrassing peace. And by the way, peace itself is embarrassing. This has to be military only, not diplomatic. So then you're not going to have foreign ministry officials negotiating. You're going to have military officers negotiating. The Egyptians were vulnerable in Gaza, and they were vulnerable in Fallujah. At any moment, Israel could reignite the war and wipe them out. But truth is, Israel was also in a tough spot. They controlled land beyond the partition borders, and the United Nations might, under some arrangement, force them to withdraw back to those partition borders, which were not very good borders. Also, Israel needed to absorb its immigrants, improve its economy, improve the mental health of its soldiers who had been stationed away from their families for months and months on end, and the desire for peace. All these things militated against renewal of hostilities. So yes, the Egyptians are afraid of the renewal of hostilities, but Israel at this point really doesn't want to do that. So each side has its reason to approach the negotiations, happy that there are negotiations, but worried that they're not going to get the best deal. Okay. The Israeli team was led by Walter Eitan, who was an English-speaking director general of the foreign ministry. And he was assisted by Yigal Yadin and Yitzhak Rabin. And you may be familiar with pictures of Yadin and Rabin poring over maps at the island of Rhodes, looking over the border situation. A very famous picture of them at Rhodes. Okay. So the generals thought that Walter Eitan was too conciliatory. But the foreign ministry official is not tough enough, like us military guys. By the way, and somebody unmute themselves and give me the answer, and you have only one choice, because there's only one obvious choice. Who later, in an important position in the foreign ministry, would be accused by the generals of being too conciliatory? You have one guess.
Peres.
That wasn't the one I was thinking of.
Rabin.
No. Abba Ibn. Abba Ibn, who wrote the Sharif from 1966 to 1974, and was considered the great eloquent spokesman of Israel, was very often regarded as too conciliatory. Whether actually in his years as ambassador to Washington and to the UN, and later as the foreign minister, he was a great defender of his people, but was often seen as giving away too much. Okay. So it was unclear who was calling the shots for the Egyptians. It was clear, however, who was calling the shots for Israel. Although certain people were on the ground at Rhodes, on any controversy, they would cable back to Tel Aviv, and Ben-Gurion or the full cabinet would make the final decision. Okay. Israel premised its negotiating position on the facts on the ground. What is the situation on the ground? Egypt had been defeated, and it should leave Palestine, inclusive of the Gaza Strip and the area of Bethlehem. Egypt, however, wanted compliance with United Nations Security Council resolutions, demanding that Israel return to its borders pre-Yoav and pre-Chorev. More broadly, Egypt wanted sovereignty in the southern Negev and central Negev to connect the Asian wing of the Arab world with the African wing of the Arab world. Israel refused. Israel insisted upon the 1906 border. What is the 1906 border? Well, it was a border that was negotiated between the Ottoman Empire and the British representing Egypt. And ultimately, that border remains the border between the sovereign state of Israel and Egypt. Okay? Bunch wanted the Americans to pressure Israel to be more conciliatory, while Israel wanted the Americans to pressure Egypt to be more conciliatory. The matter of Ahuja on the border was resolved by having the Israeli side of the border become a demilitarized zone. So that was a concession on Israel's part. The deal called for no renewal of hostilities. It was a political agreement and made very clear that these borders are not the final borders, that these are just an armistice agreement. But as for the final political borders, they are not determined by this piece of paper. So Gaza, the border between Gaza and Israel, is not an international frontier. So said this agreement. I'll mention 20 minutes from now when we conclude that Lemaisa, the world at large, does regard it as an international frontier, and that whatever is beyond that frontier is not Israel. Okay, tell it to the people in Gush Katif. That's the way it worked out. Okay, so a mixed armistice commission would supervise all the arrangements, chaired by a UN official. Egypt would keep the Gaza and was not supposed to reintroduce military rule, but in fact did. There was nothing Israel could do to stop them. Okay, let's go to the Lebanese district. Talks with Lebanon were held at a secret location at no man's land near Rosh HaNikra. It was friendly. The Lebanese pretended that they weren't really Arabs, that they were like, you know, European Christians, and that they didn't want to go to war. They only went to war because the Syrians forced them. But don't tell the Syrians that we said so, because they'll be angry with us. In other words, hush, hush, don't talk about how we're bad-mouthing our fellow Arabs. It was a collegial atmosphere between the Israelis and the Lebanese. The talks lasted 3 weeks. What was the issue at hand? Well, there were 15 villages that Israel occupied during Operation Hiram. Five of those villages had already been relinquished by Israel to Lebanon as a goodwill gesture in January. But the remaining 10 villages were still up for grabs. Mordechai Maklef, the commander of the Northern Front, represented Israel. Both sides, the Israelis and the Lebanese, agreed that the 1923 border delineated by the British and the French between British Mandate Palestine and French Mandate Lebanon would become the international border. Okay? Israel wanted Lebanon to withdraw from a few hundred yards of Israeli territory that they occupied near Rosh HaNikra. And for the Syrians to withdraw from three areas that they occupied, especially near Mishmar HaYarden, and for some minor border adjustments in the Galilee Panhandle. The Lebanese rejected the Syrian linkage. In other words, this is a talk between Israel and Lebanon, and Israel is saying, we want Syria to withdraw from there. And the Lebanese say, we don't control them. What are you introducing that into the equation? Let's have talks about what matter to us, bilateral. don't inject a Syrian equation here. So Israel was forced to accept that line of reasoning. And so in the end, the occupation of southern Lebanon, which was intended to secure the withdrawal of the Syrians from eastern Galilee, failed. The linkage didn't work out. Okay. The next thing Israel wanted was for the Lebanese to expel Syrian forces from their territory. So Israel tells Lebanon, hey guys, you have Syrian military in your country, get rid of them. To this, the Lebanese responded, hey, that's an internal Lebanese matter. Who are you to tell us what to do? Meaning we'll negotiate a deal between the two of us, but as for what happens on our side of the border with the Syrians, who are you to intrude? So Israel had to accept that. However, off the record, there was an arrangement whereby the Syrians would be forced to move north of a line between Aleppo and Tripoli. This reminds me of the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that Kennedy and Khrushchev were able to arrange that the Soviets would take their nukes out of Cuba and the Americans would take their nukes out of Turkey, but that nobody's supposed to say anything about it. Just it'll happen. So it happened. Okay. Now after the deal was signed with Egypt, and before negotiations began in earnest with Jordan, Israel decided to take its last aggressive measures for territorial expansion. And it decided to take Eilat. So Eilat, meaning the small strip of territory between Egyptian Sinai and Jordanian Aqaba on the Gulf of Aqaba, measuring only maybe 10 miles wide, if that much, maybe less, the southern tip of the Negev, that was assigned to the Jewish state in the partition plan. So Israel has good reason to say it should be ours and we want it. It was totally depopulated by late 1948. So a further reason why taking it might be plausible. The Jordanians occasionally patrolled the area, but they didn't want to reignite the war over it. So in early March, you have Operation Uvda. What is Uvda? A fact, a fait accompli. And it lasted from March 7th to March 10th. And it ended with a makeshift Israeli flag, basically a towel with blue and white markings on it, flying over an abandoned police station at Rashrash, which is today Eilat. Since the 1920s, Ben-Gurion had obsessed over the Negev. He visited the future Eilat, or what he called Etzion Gaver, based upon the Torah's language, three times in the 20s and 30s. He saw vast open space for immigrant absorption. And bear in mind, what is Zionism to David Ben-Gurion? Immigration and settlement. And if you need a place to put these people, well, the vast open space of the Negev, that's a good place as any. Ben-Gurion loves the Negev, hence Sde Boker, hence Ben-Gurion University of the Negev at Be'er Sheva. Okay? So some had thought that the reason why the taking of the southern Negev had been delayed this long, it was now March of 49 and it hadn't happened yet, some said it was because the foreign ministry, led by Moshe Sharet and other, not pacifists, but non-activists, some accused them of worrying too much about international pressure that they decided not to take this territory lest it cause a brouhaha with the West. However, Sharet denied all this. He said the real reason we didn't take Eilat sooner than we did were two factors. One, the fear of Egyptian intervention, meaning we're far away from the center of Jewish settlement. We're going to have to send some soldiers down to the middle of nowhere. The Egyptians are right there in the Sinai. Maybe they'll slaughter us. So one is Egyptian intervention. And secondly, logistically, it's very difficult to send units 100 miles or more away from the nearest Israeli settlement, Jewish settlement. So that's why in March it was finally possible, because the armistice agreement, which was sealed with Egypt on February 24th, meant you no longer had to worry about Egyptian intervention. And as for the logistical concern, that was resolved in late February when reconnaissance missions were sent periodically down the eastern, the northeastern Negev, pressing further and further into the Arava, figuring out a path. Okay, Asher has a question. Or Asher has a... Arms to temporary suspension hostilities. With Egypt and Jordan formally ending the state of war with Israel, can't such an arrangement finally made it for the Iraqis, for whom much American blood has been shed and treasure expended? The answer is the Iraqis still don't like Israel, and even with the warming of ties between Israel and, let's say, Dubai or the Emirates or even Saudi Arabia over military matters as a Jewish Sunni alliance against the Shiite threat, the Iraqis, primarily Shiite, remain implacable foes of Israel. Okay. So Israel finally was able to send units down to the southern Negev. What happened? On March 7th, two groups were sent. One went down the eastern path of the Arava border, and the other went in the central path through the Ramon crater, Machtesh Ramon. And the western wing of the assault team got there first, 3 days later, 2 hours ahead of the eastern group. The eastern group encountered some Jordanian resistance along the way, but even the Jordanians didn't want to get into a fight at this point. They fired some token shots, and nothing came of it. So by March 10th, a lot is in Israeli hands. The British didn't like this, and they beefed up defenses at Aqaba, but nothing happened. On March 7th, 8th, and 9th, the IDF also took measures to take the territory on the southeastern part of the Yam HaMelech, the Dead Sea. The southeastern Dead Sea was granted, a southwestern Dead Sea was granted to the Jewish state in the armistice agreement, but there were no Jews there. So what the IDF did was it took some speedboats from Sodom and sent them northbound to Ein Gedi, got off the boats, and took Masada. So Masada was in pre-67 Israel because of this last measure, an adjunct to Operation Uvda. Let's get to the negotiations with the Jordanians. These negotiations were long and drawn out and very difficult. Why? Why were they so challenging? Several factors. Number one, there were Iraqi troops in Samaria and Egyptian troops in Bethlehem. So it's not just a matter of placating the Jordanians or coming to terms with them. They have to be able to oust foreign soldiers that are on their territory, the Iraqis and the Egyptians. Also, there were large Arab and Jewish populations near the front lines, not just in Jerusalem, but all along the front lines. The lines were serpentine and unnatural. The green line, as it eventually would be, is not a natural border. It's just a line on a map. In fact, it's very illogical and irrational. Okay. There was the problem of the holy places and the division of Jerusalem. So what did Israel want? Israel wanted to widen its waist. Remember, the country at the narrow point, the narrow part of the coastal part of the country, was really, really narrow. I mean, there were places where only 8 or 9 miles from the coast, you had Jordanian or Iraqi forces. So you got to widen it somehow. Also, some Iraqi territory was actually allotted to the Jewish state in the partition plan. And if it was allotted to the Jewish state, Israel wants it, even though it hadn't taken it in the course of combat. King Abdullah wanted the West Bank and southern Negev annexed to Jordan. Specifically, he wanted Lod and Ramla, which were in Israeli hands. And if he couldn't get Lod and Ramla, he at least wanted the repatriation of their residents. Now, this is an important point, and let me stop here for a minute. There's a tendency to say that the Arab states don't give a damn about the Palestinians. And this was just a war of expansion for the Arab states and to kill as many Jews as they could out of bigotry. And there's a lot of truth to all that. There is a lot of truth to all that. However, when it comes to King Abdullah, he was no genocidal maniac and he wasn't even a big Jew hater. He wanted a reasonable accommodation and he behaved reasonably well in the armistice talks. But also he cared about the Palestinians. He didn't just say, I want Lod and Ramla to expand my territory. He said, if I can't get it, at least let these innocent people, these civilians, go back to their homes. He cared about the humanity of the whole story. Others, foreign leaders, did not. He also wanted Jaffa, which was supposed to go to the Arab state in the partition plan, and certain exchange of tracts of land around Jerusalem to rationalize the borders in Jerusalem. Now, the Jordanian premise was the partition borders, whereas the Israeli premise was the military status quo. Israel wanted the partition borders in the Negev, however, so Israel wants its cake and eat it too, in the sense that it wants the military status quo when it's beneficial, and it wants the partition borders when it's beneficial. So we have to acknowledge that Israel was being inconsistent here to its own advantage. But then again, so did everybody does that. Okay, Israel wanted the western fringes of Iraqi Samaria, a Jordanian withdrawal from Latrun, in order that there shouldn't be this cutout of Latrun bulging into Israel. And Israel wanted ready access, free access to Mount Scopus for the university and hospital, Mount of Olives for the cemetery, and the Western Wall for religious worship. Okay, these were all the things that Israel wanted but didn't yet have. Well, informal talks began on December 26th. Formal talks began at Rhodes on March 4th. Israel was represented by Reuven Shiloach, who would later found the Mossad, and by Moshe Dayan, who had been the central sector commander and who had made the border with Abdullah Tal to divide Jerusalem. But the real decisions were not made at Rhodes. The real decisions were made in secret in Jordan and without Ralph Bunche. The Israelis didn't really trust Ralph Bunche much, which is a shame because he was a good guy. He just wasn't pro-Israel. Now, when they couldn't come to an agreement on issues related to Jerusalem by mid-March, but there was a need for a general armistice, it was decided to postpone all Jerusalem-related issues until after the armistice was signed. Was this a good idea or a bad idea? Who wants to tell me? Good or bad? Anybody? Unmute yourself. Good or bad? It's a yes.
Yeah. Nobody wants to start fighting again.
So you think it's a good idea?
A bad idea.
Bad idea.
Bad.
Okay.
Bad
so
idea.
Bad.
I think you're right, but for a different reason. And I'll explain.
Locked everything in place.
Okay, good. So it's a bad idea in the sense that the Jerusalem-related issues almost all were with a status quo favorable to the Jordanians, which means that if the real war is settled and there's a true armistice and there's no more fighting and everybody loses the threat of continued fighting, then whatever the status quo is that you didn't really like but and didn't even agree upon but just were stuck with, well, you're stuck with it. And if it was bad for you, it remains bad for you next year and the year after and the year after for 19 years until 1967. So in hindsight, from a Jewish point of view, it turned out that maneuver, well, with a certain degree of seichel at the time, was not the best. Okay, so Abdullah feared that Israel would renew the war and take militarily that which it couldn't get by diplomatic means. You know, war is diplomacy by other means. In fact, Israel did take small swaths of territory in little operations throughout mid-March. Operation Shin Tav Shin called for the conquest of Jenin and to rectify the border in the triangle, the Arab triangle, the Umm al-Fahm triangle, the northwest corner of the West Bank. But this plan was never actualized. It wasn't put into place. The IDF commanders, even while the truce negotiations were ongoing, were bellyaching that we could conquer the West Bank in just a few days. Give us the chance. Let us do it. What are you talking with them for? We'll just bludgeon them and we'll take it. Alon called for the natural border of the Jordan River. He said that most of the West Bank inhabitants would flee and that Britain would not intervene to save Jordanian control on the west side of the river. Was Alon right? We don't know because it never happened. It's in the subjunctive. But why was Israel hesitant? Number one, because of the factor of the population. Israel's not looking to have another few hundred thousand Arabs as part of citizens of its country. And who knows if these people will flee? Unless you force them out in some not nice manner, they're going to stay. And who knows what the international condemnation will be. So Ben-Gurion was hesitant to do anything along those lines. The military commanders would have to just simmer down and say, fine, we won't do it. Okay. Abdullah knew this and was eager to settle. He knew Israel could fight again, and he desperately wanted to settle. he demanded some territory in the Judean foothills south of Hebron, and for guarantees concerning the civilian population in the areas that he was going to cede to Israel. So a deal was reached in principle on March 23rd and was signed on April 3rd. Jordan gave up a patch of land between 3 and 5 miles wide from Qalqilya all the way around the border towards Jenin. So Israel got a lot of territory from the Jordanians in peace negotiations that it didn't win in battle. This should be remembered. Many people forget this. The Jordanians were very conciliatory. Okay, what did Israel have to give up? A small little piece of territory south of Hebron that, to be honest, it wasn't even occupying. So there was a quid pro quo, but the Jews got the better of it. Iraqi forces, now this area that Israel got, included 15 Arab villages, including the triangle. And that triangle represents a significant percentage of the Arab-Israeli citizens of today. And this includes an area that in recent times, including in the Trump plan, there was discussion of giving this back to the Palestinians. In other words, sections of pre-67 Israel with a heavy dose of Arab citizenry would go to the Palestinian state in order to solve demographic problems and undo what was done 71 years ago. Okay. Now, Iraqi forces withdrew east of the river, so they're gone. The Joint Commission on Jerusalem failed to reach an agreement, and this was pretty predictable. They couldn't agree on the holy places. Therefore what? No Jewish access to the Western Wall, no resumption of the university and hospital on Mount Scopus, and no cemetery on Mount of Olives. As a result of that, what happens? The university has to build a campus at Givat Ram, Israel has to build a cemetery at Har Menuchot, and the hospital in Kerem. Okay, so everything moves westward rather than the old eastern locations. What about Jewish access to the Western Wall? So it was supposed to be the case, but it was denied. Were Jews able to daven at the Western Wall between 1949 and 1967? The answer is some people did. I knew, she passed away, someone from Parkey Synagogue, where I used to be the assistant rabbi, and she told me that she went to Israel in 1963, but she didn't go to Israel directly. She went to Turkey and then went to Jordan on a vacation and went to East Jerusalem as a tourist and went to the Western Wall as an American tourist and davened, a little davening, at the Western Wall, then went through Mandelbaum Gate into Israel, had her passport stamped, and never went to the Arab world again. So it was possible for Western Jews, in theory, if they're not afraid of going to Jordan, to somehow get to the Kotel. But that's, you know, a funny story about, you know, a rare occasion. But the Jews of Israel could have no access to the holy places for 19 years. Okay, what about bypass roads? The answer is the Derech Ha'avot, the Derech Hebron, the Derech Beit Lechem, were in pre-67 Israel. So for the Arabs of the West Bank who wanted to travel from Ramallah to Beit Lechem or Hebron, they now had to build a bypass road that went through East Jerusalem, and they did. And from an Israeli point of view, Israel had to build a bypass road to avoid Latrun, and that became Highway 1, or the old Highway 1. Okay. What about Syria? So Syria was impossible, real impossible. And they did so on purpose, to prove how anti-Zionist they really were. Now, the Iraqis are the most anti-Zionist, but the Syrians of those countries that border Israel wanted to prove we're the most anti-Zionist. And so they don't want to cooperate with anything. Talks began on April 5th at the edge of the Syrian enclave near Mishmar HaYarden. Mordechai Maklef, the northern commander, led the delegation. The Syrians had no foreign ministry officials, only military officials, to show this was not a political thing of recognizing the Jewish state. This is just a glorified ceasefire. Israel wanted Syria to withdraw from the three enclaves that it had across the border, southeast of the Kinneret, north of the Kinneret at Mishmar HaYarden, and in the north, east of Dan near the Banyas. So those were three territories in Israel, which should have been Israel, that were occupied by Syrian army forces. So Syria, for its part, wanted Israel to withdraw from the territory it occupied in Operation Hiram, in other words, the north central Galilee. The fallback Syrian position, once Israel refused to do that, was to insist upon the status quo, meaning, okay, Israel, you don't withdraw from anything, but we also don't withdraw from anything. We get to keep three parts of Israel because we feel like it. Okay. Syria also wanted a general ceasefire first before negotiating an armistice. And Israel refused because Syria was untrustworthy. And if the threat of force was needed, it had to be there. If you had a general ceasefire first, then Syria might walk away and never bother signing a more robust armistice. So talks dragged on for a month. Nothing's going on. Israel prepared Operation Pine Tree, which called for the conquest of the Golan Heights, including Quneitra, and a threatening move towards Damascus. But Ben-Gurion hesitated to authorize it. Ralph Bunche recognized that Israel is gearing up for another fight, and he's got to do something to stop it. So he proposes demilitarization of the evacuated areas. In other words, everybody goes behind their borders, and whatever is evacuated, no military forces are allowed to come in. It remains demilitarized. All right. Well, in Syria, Asher has a comment. My first trip to Israel was in 1966, and my memory was of distance visiting the Kotel is fuzzy. It's possible to recall that I viewed it behind the established wire separating my Arif. Okay, fine. Correct. So you were able to visit Mount Zion, Har Zion, which was in Israeli hands, and if you went up to the top of the building where there's Kever David, you could see from the top of that building into the Jewish quarter, and you could get a glimpse of the upper stones of the Kotel behind a lot of barbed wire. So it was possible to get a glimpse of the holy places from a distance of about a kilometer and a half. Correct. Okay. So in Syria, Colonel Zaim took over in a coup. And he proposed a peace deal with Israel. Whoa. So a Syrian is proposing a real peace deal, not just an armistice, but a peace deal with Israel. And he demanded a face-to-face meeting with David Ben-Gurion. How do you like that? He wanted the new border to be halfway across the Kinneret and the Jordan River. In other words, right smack in the middle, like in the Hudson River is halfway across is New Jersey and New York. He wanted Israel and Syria to be halfway down the Kinneret and halfway down the Jordan. Ben-Gurion refused the offer. He refused to entertain it. Why? After all, isn't peace a good thing? Well, number one, he thought that Zaim wasn't serious, that this is a bluff, a joke. But also, Ben-Gurion was a firm believer in the importance of water, water, water. And so Israel's not going to give up half of the lake, which is its primary source of water, and half of the Jordan. You got to be crazy to do that. If anything, the history of Israeli-Syrian relations is Israel's expansionism to try to occupy the Banyas and the Dan, the tributaries of the Jordan, in 1967, because you need these sources to quench the thirst of your people. Moshe Levison says, that's where we davened Tisha B'Av when I was there at King David's Kever. Correct, yes, on Mount Zion. Okay, so, now, instead, what did Ben-Gurion insist upon? That the Syrians first withdraw and then negotiate peace. They haggled with Ralph Bunche over the extent of the demilitarized zones. What is the status of these DMZs? The Syrians regard them as places where nobody is sovereign. It's not Israel. It's not Syria. It's something in between. The Israelis, however, regarded them as Israeli territory, where Israel is sovereign, but where the Israeli military is barred from approaching. That machlokis, by the way, remained up until the Six-Day War, and was one of the reasons for the Six-Day War, was Israeli tractors encroaching upon the DMZ on purpose to try to precipitate a dogfight between the IAF and Syrian Air Force. Okay. Israel and Syria agreed to a limitation of forces along the border, which was important to keep things from getting too hostile too quickly. And the deal was struck on July 20th. The Syrians withdrew, and local police administered the area. Where Arabs lived, it was local Arab policemen. Where Jews lived, it was local Jewish policemen, but no military of either country. The war ended and was replaced with de jure non-belligerency. The armistice lines, though not supposed to be international borders, became de facto international borders, insofar as any inch of territory beyond that border is regarded by the United Nations and the world at large as not being Israel, that Israel is limited to its borders of the armistices of 49. And anything beyond it is an occupation of some sort. But what about the other countries that take it, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, the Syrians? Is it an occupation? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. And there's a double standard in play about moral objections to Israel's taking of extra territory versus the other countries. But the bottom line is Israel was lucky to come away with 78% of British mandate Palestine when they were only supposed to get 55%. Okay. Now, David Ben-Gurion regarded these deals as de facto peace deals, which then removed any responsibility he felt that was upon his shoulders to try to conclude a real peace deal. In other words, if you study Israeli diplomatic history from July of 49 through the Suez War, there's really no attempt whatsoever on the part of the Israeli government to enter into full-scale peace deals, including diplomatic relations and exchange of ambassadors and that sort of thing, with neighboring states. That the armistice was seen as good enough. However, the Arabs didn't view it that way. The Arabs viewed it not as de facto peace deals, but rather only as glorified ceasefires, and therefore, if they were to not be replaced with something more substantial, the renewal of hostilities would be certain. And we know the rest of the story. The renewal of hostilities did happen. How were they renewed? Well, on the Egyptian frontier, they were renewed with Fedayeen raids all throughout the early 1950s, and Israel's response, including Operation Black Hawk in 1955, which was a major operation, and eventually the 1956 war. On the Jordanian front, well, there was operations at Qibya in 1953, for which Israel was roundly criticized, and there were the occasional raids into the West Bank. On the northern front, you have encroachment into the DMZ. So there was no peace, at all. There maybe was 10 years of quiet between 1957 and 67, but certainly the armistice agreements were insufficient to render this into a Gan Eden. It wasn't. It was Israel became a garrison state surrounded by hostile countries that don't like it. Okay, we'll stop here. Any questions? Questions? Don't hesitate to ask.
Yeah, I wanted to explain. So what does the armistice mean then? Just like,
it's a glorified ceasefire that says you're not going to renew hostilities anytime soon, and that you'll abide by whatever restrictions on the use of force are agreed to, but it is sometimes part of a diplomatic arrangement, including recognition by both sides of the sovereignty of the other side. In this case, it did not include that.
But it did include the borders.
What was that?
Did it include the borders as it landed at the end of that?
Okay, so the borders were the primary element of the armistice. It's what will the frontier be? And the answer is, as we've discussed, in part based upon the military status quo, in part based on swaps of land in the case of Israel and Jordan, and in part based upon evacuation of military forces but not replacing them with the other side. In the case of Syria, we have demilitarized zones. So the borders are the critical ingredient, but in each case, at each front, how they got to decide where the border would be was based upon specific considerations in play at that front.
Okay. But it permitted some paramilitary activity, like the Fedayeen, for example, that blossomed during the late 50s. No?
Right. So paramilitary activity is the big problem that you have when there's no diplomatic recognition of the sovereignty of the two sides. If you have recognition of the two sides, you can't engage in paramilitary activity. It's just, it's asur, it's verboten.
Right.
You recognize the existence of the other side, and you just have a deal between the formal armed forces, my army and your army. Well, Fedayeen are not an army, they're just a bunch of ragtag hoodlums. Whatever they do is whatever they do. Of course, we know the Egyptians were funding them and paying for it, but, you know, it's That was their prerogative. Okay, so we'll stop here.
Thank you.
So we've gotten almost pretty much as far as I can to go with this course. However, I want to do a few more sessions, maybe two more sessions before we go to another topic altogether. I want to do next time Israel's admission to the United Nations, and maybe after that, or maybe also next week, the question of the internationalization of Jerusalem, which became a hot-button issue late in 1949 at the UN, and which caused Israel to make Jerusalem its capital. Okay, everybody, have a good night.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Good night.